Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
An Egyptian court designates the Islamic State as a terrorist group and increasing violence by the Taliban in Afghanistan. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. An Egyptian court has designated the Islamic State as a terrorist group. The court said today it considers all affiliates of the insurgent group to be terrorist organizations, including Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, an Egyptian jihadi group that pledged its allegiance to the Islamic State earlier this month. Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis is often responsible for attacks on Egyptian security forces in the Sinai Peninsula since the army ousted Islamist President Mohamed Morsi last year. Meanwhile, Syrian activists say in the last 24 hours, at least 50 Islamic State militants were killed in the fight for Kobani, a Syrian town just south of the Turkish border. Pope Francis of the Roman Catholic Church is concluding a three-day visit to Turkey, meeting with the head of the Orthodox Christian Church. The two Christian leaders called for an end to persecution of Christians in the region. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
On the final day of his visit to Turkey, Pope Francis celebrated St. Andrew's Day at the Patriarchal Church of St. George in Istanbul. The Pope sat opposite Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, who heads a 250-million-strong Orthodox Church. The two leaders signed a joint declaration to prevent Christianity from being driven out the region. The Pope met with Christian refugees during his time in Istanbul. Pope Francis and Patriarch Bartholomew say persecution is giving added impetus to their reunification efforts. During a homily to the Orthodox faithful, the Pope said his goal is full unity, but he said such unity would not mean assimilation or loss of their traditions. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
There are 1.2 billion Roman Catholics in the world. This is VOA News. Kabul's police chief has resigned following a string of Taliban attacks on foreign targets in Afghanistan's capital city. General Mohammad Zahir stepped down today shortly after officials confirmed a South African man, his two children, and an Afghan man died in an assault yesterday on a foreign guest house in a secure neighborhood. The government's interior ministry spokesman said two gunmen were shot to death. A third attacker detonated explosives strapped to his body. Sadiq Siddiqui says it also appears the violence is related to the Afghan government signing new agreements going forward to work with U.S. forces in securing the country. The guest house attack was the latest in a string of assaults in the same neighborhood, home to several embassies and international organizations. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack, saying the house was a center for Christian evangelism. Ebola, the death toll there has reached just under 7,000, up more than 1,000 since the previous report just 2 days earlier, according to the World Health Organization. WHO officials said a large number of previously unreported deaths with a sudden sharp rise in the number of Ebola fatalities. It says a little more than 16,000 people have been diagnosed with the disease since March. Switzerland votes today on whether to impose radical limits on immigration, a referendum opponents to the proposal have called disastrous for the economy. The so-called Ecopop initiative would cap immigration growth at 0.2% of the population, an addition of roughly 16,000 people annually instead of the current growth rate of 80,000 per year. The initiative also calls for Switzerland to use 10% of its international development aid budget for family planning programs abroad. The white police officer who fatally shot an unarmed black teenager in the U.S. state of Missouri after a street confrontation has resigned. A lawyer for Officer Darren Wilson said Saturday his resignation from the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department is effective immediately. Opinions among townsfolk were mixed.
And there's still such a large, great grudge against him, unfortunately. People can't come to grips with the facts of the evidence of the case. So it's just, I would hope he can do what he did here, someplace where he would enjoy life and move on with his life.
I believe he should have resigned. I do believe he should have been found guilty.
Wilson had been on administrative leave since the shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown in August in the St. Louis suburb. Meanwhile, protests continued yesterday, and the demonstrators have just set off on a seven-day, 193-kilometer march to the Missouri state capital of Jefferson City. Voters in Moldova are voting in a crucial parliamentary election today, which analysts say is particularly unwell-disguised referendum on whether the impoverished ex-Soviet country should pursue integration with Europe or return to Russia's fold. Surveys indicate public opinion is equally divided on the issues and the parties. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
It's been very unfortunate that the government normally doesn't want to be supervised by the parliament. The government wants to be advised. They're muting the fifth function. So we think what we're doing is correct.
The Tanzanian parliament demands that President Kikwete sacks cabinet ministers accused of corruption. Who have details?
The tension that was in the country during their presence is slowly easing, and people are beginning to feel that some sort of calm.
Political tension in Lesotho eases following the recent attempt to overthrow Prime Minister Thabane's government.
The problem is that Ebola did have a big head start. It is present in a lot of places. It is present in big cities. It is present in small villages.
And will the United Nations mission contain the dreaded Ebola disease in Sierra Leone? Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Public Accounts Committee of the Tanzanian Parliament has called for a thorough investigation. This after accusing senior government officials and a banking institution of corruption and money laundering. The officials denied the charge. Diofile Kunjombe is the vice chairman of the parliamentary committee. I reached him earlier today in the commercial capital Dar es Salaam and asked him to substantiate the charges.
We are not happy with the conduct of some ministers, of some government officials. And we said we must take actions. It was tough, yes. It was very tough. But I'm glad that eventually we came out with 8 strong resolutions. So for the government, we'll commend to the president to remove out the Minister of Energy and Minerals, the Attorney General, the Permanent Secretary, Minister of Energy and Minerals, and the Minister of Land, Professor Tubajuka, who confessed having received $1 million as proceeds of the same money.
Parliament basically wants to do its business by keeping all the arms of government in check, about ensuring transparency, the rule of law, and ensuring the public money is protected. Is this the case?
Yes, it is. The Constitution spells very clearly, 63.2, says the function number one of the parliament is to supervise the government, and number two is to advise the government. It's been very unfortunate that the government normally doesn't want to be supervised by the parliament. The government wants to be advised. They are muting the first function. So we think what we're doing is correct. It is our mandate, and of the three pillars, categorically, the Constitution spells out the parliament is the supreme organ.
Some Tanzanians express concern that some of them don't espouse confidence in the judiciary. What impact do you think this will have on the judiciary as a supervisory body in parliament?
I don't want to comment overall. That was not part of our committee to find out if the judiciary is trusted or not. But what we found out categorically, that there are 2 judges who have received proceeds of crime. You know, you having a judge receiving $1 million for what? You're having 2 judges there who have, we have found from bank statement that they received money. So we have asked, as per the Constitution, that they become suspended and then an inquiry be conducted on their morals and ethics and if they really deserve to be still judges or not. So basically, we found 2 judges involved in this. It is just like we found, yes, 2 MPs, members of parliament, who are also chairs of committees, have received this money. So whatever we have committed to the parliament, they get removed from their positions as chairs, and other disciplinary action should be taken upon them. So we are very strict. Whoever that we came out and found out dealt in this transaction, this dubious transaction, we recommended for 10 actions to be taken upon them.
Apart from these recommendations of the removal of these ministers, does that mean that other measures were recommended to be meted out to these people found to have committed this act of graft or corruption?
I said there is 8 resolutions. I've given you just 2 or 3. We have gone deeper than that. We have commended for other institutions to go deeper and dig deeper, investigate. And if personally these people are found guilty, then they should be taken to court. There should be a rule of law should take its course. So we've recommended for deeper, like the Bank of Stanbic, which we believe didn't perform its task correctly, like doing due diligence. You know, there was huge amounts of money being withdrawn from the bank, cash, against our financial regulations. Why did the banks allow that? People would go out with money into bags and boxes. How would a bank allow that? So we have made recommendations to these financial institutions, like Stanbic Bank, to be recommended as a money laundering institution. So now that one, now we leave it to the central bank. So we have made recommendations to each organ, to each institution, to each person that was involved to be dealt with accordingly. So basically, there are 8 resolutions. You have taken me by surprise. I left the resolutions in my car. I would have given you all of them, then you can see how serious we are.
Diophile Kunjombe is the vice chairman of the Public Accounts Committee of Tanzania's parliament. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. The spokesman for Lesotho Prime Minister Thomas Tabani said political tension in the Southern African Kingdom has reduced after senior security officials left separately on vacation. The trips abroad are part of a peace agreement mediated by the South African Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa. Thabo Takwalekwala is the spokesman for the Prime Minister. I reached him in the capital Maseru and asked him for clarification.
The situation is slowly coming back to normal. The tension that was in the country during the presence is slowly easing, and people are beginning to feel that some sort of calm has descended over the country.
How is the coalition government functioning now following the signing of the peace agreement by all political parties?
The coalition government is still functioning. The only challenge that is faced by the coalition government is that the deputy prime minister has since distanced himself away from the business of government. But at times he attends cabinet meetings, at times he doesn't attend.
But the prime minister recently fired one of the ministers for over insubordination. That is being challenged in court. Some of his critics are saying that he is being a bully in the coalition government, and that is part of the problem that created the sharp disagreement in the country that nearly led to the coup d'etat. What do you say to that?
That argument doesn't hold water because this is the first time that Lesotho has had a coalition government. And the constitution of Lesotho does not say anything about a coalition government. The constitution of Lesotho simply says that the prime minister can advise the head of state, who is currently the third, to remove any government minister from his position. And the prime minister, when he removed that minister, he was exercising his powers within the constitution of Lesotho.
So what is the next step forward now that tension seemed to be easing and Basotho are feeling some sense of improved security and business is gradually returning to normal? South Africa's deputy president Ramaphosa is scheduled to come to the country to help move the process forward. What is the next step forward?
Yes, I understand that he will be coming to Lesotho next week. And remember, next week is the deadline for the dissolution of parliament. So it is possible that when he gets to Lesotho next week, he will definitely ask the prime minister to advise the head of state, the king, to dissolve parliament. And on the other side, the Independent Electoral Commission, which is in charge of organizing and preparing for elections due in February next week, they are busy preparing for those elections. So all I can say is that the parliament will be dissolved early next week, probably on the 2nd or the 3rd of December. And then after that, government business will be geared towards preparation for February elections. And Mr. Ramaphosa will be fully involved in all the process. That is why he's coming to Lesotho next week. But again, he will be coming to Lesotho next week to address certain security challenges that still face the country. I'm sure you remember that there were soldiers who were following Lieutenant General Tamudi, and those soldiers are still at large. And it is the duty of SADC to make sure that they go back to barracks. Those who have committed crimes are brought to book, they're brought before the court of law. So this is the challenge that is facing SADC in the person of Mr. Ramaphosa when he comes back to the country early next week.
Thabo Takwalekwala is the spokesman for Lesotho's prime minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. Turning to West Africa, in Sierra Leone, the Ebola disease has been raging. The head of the United Nations Mission for Ebola Emergency Response, or UNMEER, Amadou Camara, says the December 1st deadline will not be met. For VOA, Kelvin Lewis reports from the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown.
The United Nations Mission for Ebola Emergency Response, or UNMEER, representative in Sierra Leone is Amadou Camara. Speaking to reporters, Amadou Camara says that initial targets set for end November will not be met.
We tried to make sure that we did 70% of all burials safely and with dignity, as well as to ensure that all clinical cases of Ebola is either isolated or under safe treatment facilities. Together we set ourselves these 60 days to reach the target, but we acknowledge that we may not be able to reach all of these goals by December 1st.
The UNMEER representative says the confirmed cases of Ebola have continued to rise.
Countrywide, there were 500 new confirmed, probable and suspected cases this week, with the highest incidence in western urban area, about 148 cases, western rural 75, and Putlocko 105. But in some places, in some other places like Kalaun, Kenema, and Koinedugu, we've seen that we can get ahead of the disease.
The international community has stepped up its support in recent days. This week, the U.S. envoy to Sierra Leone, Ambassador Hoover, handed over 24 vehicles and 27 motorbikes as part of the donation made by Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg and wife. The UNMEER representative says he's hopeful the fight against Ebola will be won soon.
We can also see the impact of our scaling up of our response. On October 1, which was the beginning of the 60 days, we had 2,152 contact traces. Now we have 3,510 in place. At the start of October, we had only 4 Ebola treatment units. Now we have 11. Since then, we have also distributed 5,500 tons of food and nutritional assistance to around 650,000 people. These are measures that work. We know it. We have seen them work in our own communities, and it's the most important indicator of all. The problem is that Ebola did have a big head start. It is present in a lot of places. It is present in big cities. It is present in small villages. But we know the strategy works, and we know together we can beat this disease.
The figures this week have not been encouraging. The western area, which houses the capital Freetown, has now registered 2,015 confirmed cases, contributing 35% to the country totals. Nearly 6,000 people have contracted the disease, and nearly 1,500 have died. For VOA Africa, I'm Kelvin Lewis reporting from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
V The Zimbabwean public is closely following development within President Robert Mugabe's ruling ZANU-PF party. For a sense of the media's role at this point, Studio 7's Indimiake Mwakalyeli sought comment from Eden Wetherell of the weekly Zimbabwe Independent newspaper and journalism professor Stanford Mukasa. Wetherell says the private media is striving to report fairly.
Well, we'd like to say that essentially the reading public who will define whether we are successful or not. We would like to say we are, that we have an active, supportive role in the media. We hope that we're performing a useful service to the public of Zimbabwe.
Professor Mukasa, what has been your observation of the way this unfolding crisis within ZANU-PF has been covered?
Well, there are two media systems in Zimbabwe. There is the independent news on one hand, and of course the state-supported and funded media. Until about the elections, they were all united, I mean, that is the state-supported media, in supporting ZANU, both factions. No secrets were ever revealed about either faction before independence. Now, with the apparent ascendancy of one faction, presumably led by Mnangagwa, we see a lot of detail and secrets about the other faction. I'm sure Mr. Woodrow will agree with me that at this point they are enjoying some break. And they are now observers.
Absolutely enjoying it and watching because, the two sides, the government,
yes,
press.
Yes.
And ourselves engaging in mortal combat. This is an interesting role, and it's one which we're not going to give up too easily.
Well, staying with you, Mr. Wetherell, the challenge now is on the independent papers, which also for a long time had been popped up as anti-government. How do they fare in terms of the coverage also of the conflict within ZANU-PF, and then also you have the conflict within the opposition parties?
Yes, it's very interesting, of course, watching developments within ZANU-PF, that this role hasn't been played before by either side. And it's going to be interesting to see which way it goes. But the role of the independent press is to monitor these clashes of the titans and going about the business that way.
Professor Mukasa, when you look at the history of, for one, the state papers, and second, the independent papers, there's always been a bias, one for the government, one for the opposition. Now it seems as though there are splinters. Are papers or the media being caught up in who to follow, or is that sense of objectivity still being practiced, from your observation?
Objectivity in the Zimbabwean journalistic sense is really subjective. You are objective to the extent that you determine that you are objective. But what I really see, and this is a tragedy, the country is heading over the cliff. And there's so much preoccupation with the Nongo, Grace Mugabe, you know, sort of what I would call Mahumbwe politics. You know, this is just a child play compared to the seriousness of the economic situation in the country.
Stanford Mukasa is an independent commentator and journalism professor at the Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Also on the panel from Harare was Aiden Wetherell of the weekly Zimbabwe Independent. Both spoke with Studio 7's Indimiake Mwakalyeli. Nigerian writer Jude Dibia says gay people in Nigeria and elsewhere in Africa are increasingly fearful of, quote, outing themselves because of laws and other repressive measures that discriminate against them. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Dibia says restrictions on free expression are driving LGBTI, that is, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex communities further underground. Reporter Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
Award-winning Nigerian writer Jude Dibia's first novel, Walking with Shadows, has as its central character a gay man who lives his life as a married family man. The title of the book is appropriate because, as Dibia explains, gay people in Nigeria do not officially exist. They are forced to live in the shadows.
Being gay in Nigeria is so funny because you can't admit to it. You have to pass as something else and create a different persona and live that persona. And sometimes for some people, they end up being married and they have families and they try to suppress who they are. But, you know, there's a lot of depression and struggles there.
Dibia's novel was the first to deal with the taboo subject of homosexuality in Nigeria. On a personal note, he says writing this book has allowed him to discover who he is and to make some changes in his own way of thinking and living as a gay man. He calls the experience therapeutic and says he has become more comfortable in his own skin. He says both he and a small independent publisher in Nigeria put up the money to finance the publication of Walking with Shadows. He says bookstores in Nigeria have refused to stock the book, but Dibia says it has been selling by word of mouth and has become his best-selling novel in the country. He says the book has triggered a debate on gay rights and has changed the discussion of LGBTI issues in Nigeria.
There was a discussion that was started, and that was very positive. Before people, when you mention gay, it's like under the table in whispers. It was such a taboo word to even say homosexual in public. But now people could talk about homosexuals in the context of my novel without it sounding like a dirty word. It was more of a discussion and a debate on, oh, the character this and the character that, why did he do, you know. So I started more or less a sort of discussion.
But gay people in Nigeria are not safe. Their sexual orientation is putting them at greater risk since the passage of Nigeria's repressive new law on homosexuality on January 7th. Gay sex is banned in 38 of Africa's 54 countries, but the Nigerian law goes further than that. Under the law, people in same-sex relationships can be imprisoned for 14 years. The operation of gay clubs and gatherings of gay people is forbidden and can result in a 10-year jail term. And even public displays of affection by gay men and lesbian women are criminalized. Jude Dibia says the law is having a profoundly chilling effect upon the gay community.
People have gone further underground, but they still are trying to survive. And I think maybe that's why online now on the internet and on blogs, you're seeing more stories coming out. There's a lot of anger festering in the, you know, in the underbelly, but more stories are popping out there because of this law. And I think it's a good thing in its own way. It's a good thing.
Dibia has had threats against his life. Currently, he lives in exile in the United States. He says he would like to go home, but it is not safe for him to do so. He says he would rather continue his work outside his country than go back and lose his right of freedom of expression. He says he does not expect the Nigerian government to change its attitude toward homosexuality overnight, but he is sure some change eventually will come. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, remembering Dr. Ali Mazarui, one of Africa's greatest thinkers. Dr. Mazarui died October 12th. The Kenyan intellectual spoke for the continent and leaves generations past and present and future. That's next time on VOA Africa. Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Sunday Shomari. Next on Let's Talk, Names in Africa. Names in Africa is the topic we'll discuss in our new light-hearted show, Let's Talk. So join me, Sunday Shomari, and my guests as we explore names in Africa with some hilarity. That's Let's Talk, Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Tlote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. That, indeed, will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. For Sunday, November 30th, the first leg final of the 2014 CAF Confederation Cup, Africa's second-tier club football competition, was played on Saturday in Ivory Coast's commercial city of Abidjan. Home team Sewe Sport defeated the Egyptian giant Al Ahly 2-1, taking a very slim advantage into the second leg in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Christian Kofi Kwame and Roger Asali scored for the Ivorian club, while Mahmoud Hassan scored an important away goal for Al Ahly. The return leg will be played in Cairo on December 16th. Sewe Sports is seeking to become the first Ivorian club to win Continental Club Championship since 1998. On the other hand, Al Ahly is seeking to become the first Egyptian club to win the CAF Confederation Cup. Al Ahly holds the record of most victories in Africa's other club football competition, the more prestigious CAF Champions League, with 8 titles. It has also won 6 CAF Super Cup, which pitches the winners of Africa's 2 club football competitions. The winner of the CAF Confederation Cup will pocket $660,000 and will also face the winner of the CAF Champions League in the 2015 CAF Super Cup. Staying with African football, there is bad news for Ghana ahead of the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations due to start on January 17th in Equatorial Guinea. Ghana international Kwadwo Asamoah has been ruled out of the competition. Asamoah's Italian club Juventus ruled him out of the tournament after announcing he will undergo knee surgery that will sideline him for up to 3 months. The Ghana international missed training with his club on Friday and will fly to Barcelona, Spain, on Tuesday in order to have surgery to repair cartilage in his left knee. He had been complaining of persistent knee pain, according to a statement on the club's official website. Last week, Ghana named Israeli trainer Avram Grant to succeed Kwesi Appiah as coach of the Black Stars, as Ghana's national team is known. Ghana Football Association President Kwesi Nyatachi said the new coach has been charged with the task of, quote, doing well at the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations and winning the 2017 tournament, unquote. Nyatachi also revealed that Grant will be assisted by Maxwell Konadi, who was named as caretaker coach after Appiah parted company with the GFA. And from Cameroon comes the report that the Emergency Committee of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA, has allowed the postponement of the elections of the Cameroon Football Association, FECAFOOT. The elections, which were scheduled for November 29th, will now take place by February 28, 2015, at the latest. The Emergency Committee said it has also extended the mandate of the Normalization Committee accordingly, and that the elections should take place according to the new statutes adopted on August 23, 2014. The committee said the decisions were made based on feedback from the Cameroonian authorities, who had expressed concern over security ahead of the upcoming FECAFOOT elections. Away from African football, the health of Brazilian soccer legend Pele continued to improve on Saturday, although he remained in intensive care units to allow doctors to monitor a urinary tract infection. The 74-year-old three-time World Cup champion is receiving renal support treatment to help his kidneys filter waste products from his blood. He underwent surgery earlier this month to remove kidney stones. Pele has struggled with many health problems over the past decade. He has had emergency eye surgery for a detached retina and a hip replacement. Known in Brazil as the King of Soccer, he played in 4 World Cups and scored over 1,000 goals during his career. Finally, World Cup champion Germany says it will play the United States in an exhibition game on June 10, 2015 in Cologne. Germany's football governing body announced the date and venue on its website on Friday. Germany beat the United States 1-0 in its final group stage match at the 2014 FIFA World Cup before going ahead to win the title. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thank you for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports.
Metro Studio Internationale.
It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Papa Musove.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Recently, in commenting on the report issued by our office regarding the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, action on a Turkish flotilla on a mission to deliver humanitarian assistance to Gaza in 2010, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, Mrs. Fatou Bensouda, asserted that on the basis of information available to the ICC, there was a reasonable basis to believe that there was crime committed on board the Mavi Marmara during the interception of the flotilla in 2010 in the context of an international armed conflict. But she reaffirmed a carefully worded report by pointing out that our office had concluded that the potential case that would likely arise from an investigation of the flotilla incident would not be of sufficient gravity to justify further action by the court. Whatever one may think of the wisdom of a decision, it represents a perfect example of the prosecutor's prosecutorial discretion. It has become relevant only because the prosecutor's discretion has not been evoked or applied in the case of the African continent. In response to widespread criticism, particularly by Africans, that the ICC was only concerned about alleged crimes in Africa, the former ICC chief prosecutor, Mr. Luis Moreno Ocampo, and now the current chief prosecutor, Mrs. Bensouda, are in the habit of trumpeting the fact that the cases against Africans were referred to the courts merely by Africans as of state themselves, ignoring the possibility that these allegations were triggered for political or other non-legal reasons. The ICC prosecutors have abandoned their prosecutorial discretion. This has been one of the key points stressed by many African critics of the ICC. Prosecutors do not have to litigate before courts all cases brought to their attention, as in the case of the Israeli case. Lately, Chief Prosecutor Bensouda has opted for another example explanation to deny that the ICC is biased against the African continent. Quote, "I am an African," she often remarked. But those who live in a real planet know very well that the fact that there does not exist any guarantee that international or even national institutions headed by an African or containing African members would protect African interests or people of color. Accordingly, this argument is not a valid one. Significantly, what the Israeli case and decision of the prosecutor revealed is the fact this commentator has often emphasized, owing to the fact that the African continent is widely seen as quote-unquote sick man of the international community, it could be pushed around without impunity. It could bark, but not bite, as it used to do in the 1960s and 1970s. Not to go after Israel was perhaps a prudent decision for the ICC. To do otherwise would have shaken the foundation of the ICC. You cannot mess with Israel. Nevertheless, the ICC should never forget that many Africans, even those that are critical of the ICC, want to fight impunity. While they accept the legality of the institution, many question its credibility. Not all critics of the ICC are ill wishers. The ICC came into being only because many African states believe in the fight against impunity. They signed and ratified the Rome Statute, which made it possible for the ICC to exist. It is ironic indeed that some of the states that are today supporting cases before the ICC have never ratified the Rome Statute. I thank you.
Thank you very much. And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Brian Makulie, we say thanks for joining us. And as elders in Kenya say, those who arrive to the spring first drink the purest water. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nearly one-fourth of the world's population, some 1.8 billion people, are between the ages of 10 and 24, according to the United Nations 2014 State of World Population Report. Nonetheless, young people are often overlooked, shut out of the decision-making process, and their needs are often disregarded. This tendency cries out for urgent correction, states the report, because it imperils youth as well as economies and societies at large. There is a strong correlation between poverty and low investment in the well-being and development of young people. In most countries, their numbers compound challenges in escaping violence, in finding dignified work, or in gaining access to decent schooling and youth-friendly health services, including reproductive health and family planning services, notes the report. And this, in turn, feeds the vicious cycle of poverty. The report points out that 9 out of 10 young people live in less developed countries where schooling and jobs are scarce. Many lack access to reproductive health information and services. U.S. Assistant Secretary for Population, Refugees and Migration, Ann Richard, who spoke on the release of the report, emphasized that these are services young people need to preserve their options, pursue their future goals, and even save their own lives. Too many girls, about 39,000 every day, are subjected to early and forced marriage. Some of these child brides are as young as 8. As Assistant Secretary Richard pointed out, the consequences of early marriage and young people's unmet need for contraceptives can be grave. Among 15 to 19-year-old girls in low- and middle-income countries, complications from pregnancy and unsafe abortions are a leading cause of death. And while HIV fatalities for other age groups are falling, among adolescents, they are rising. The United States strongly supports the report's recommendations, including stopping early enforced marriage, adolescent pregnancies, and harmful practices such as female genital mutilation, improving access to reproductive health care for the young, preventing gender-based violence, promoting equal education for girls, and improving young people's employment opportunities. We now know just how much is at stake, not only the risks of failure, but the enormous benefits within reach with the right mix of enlightened policies and effective programs, said Assistant Secretary Richard. Young people deserve the chance to pursue their dreams and to thrive. As this report shows very clearly, by helping youth secure their future, we can also secure ours.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.